From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how changes in farming methods can protect our topsoils from eroding. Then how one Wisconsin family's devastating experience with medical error became a beacon of hope and a call for reform.
The best thing that's happened is the film has turned into a call to action. That was not the intention. I just wanted to tell my mom's story. But now it's no longer our movie. It's the patients out there and their families.
And Milwaukee writer Nick Petrie is back with book 5 in his Peter Ash series. He says he sets himself a challenge in every book.
Part of the assignment for this one was to put Peter, is to really sort of isolate him and to make him as miserable as I possibly could. To see how deep he could dig and how much trouble he could get into and get out of.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Of the many climate crises we face, soil erosion isn't usually on the top of people's lists, but it should be. Without topsoil, we can't grow food, and without food, civilizations collapse. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that our agricultural soil erodes at an average rate of almost 5 tons of topsoil per acre per year. In contrast, soil regenerates at less than 1/10 of that rate. Farming practices contribute to the loss, as does global warming. But our next guest says we can fix it. Dr. Joe Handelsman is the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison, and she's a research professor at the Department of Plant Pathology. She joined me from her office in Madison last month to explain how our farming practices are contributing to soil loss.
The main thing we're doing is what soil is generally used for, which is crop production. And the methods that humans have used for crop production for literally thousands of years are very destructive to the structure of the soil and make it very vulnerable to erosion. So it's not something that is unique to modern farming. And in fact, many civilizations over thousands of years of history of agriculture have collapsed because they have eroded their soil, and their soil has been destroyed by plowing, which is the main destructive technique we use, and then exposure to hard rain and wind that will take the soil away. We know better now. We know how to preserve soil, and that's the happy part of the story, is that we're losing our soil very rapidly, but we could turn that around in a very short period of time if we put our minds to it.
So plowing, as you say, is the primary way we plant crops. What should we be doing differently that would allow us to still plant and grow food without destroying the very thing that's allowing us to grow the food?
Well, there are three techniques in farming that are well known and very widely used, but not widely enough. And the first is no-till planting, which is where the seeds are actually drilled into last year's crop residue, so, you know, the stubble or whatever's left over from last year, and the soil is never broken up and turned. It's just it receives the seed with this drill. That was a method developed years ago and is used, ironically, more in other countries than in the United States. I think of our agricultural land, about a third or less is under no-till conditions, whereas in Brazil, 3/4 of their cropland is no-till. So that's one that we could switch to, and there are barriers for farmers for all of these, so I'm not minimizing that, but these are the methods that will work. The second is cover crops, which hold the soil in place when we're not growing anything for crop production in it. So in Wisconsin, for example, we will often harvest the crop in the fall. Some farmers will plow after harvest, and then there will be nothing, it's just bare soil until planting in the spring. And so for 7 or 8 months a year, that soil can be bare. And we should never have bare soil. That makes it so vulnerable to removal by wind and water. So cover crops are crops that are planted usually in the fall and cover the land over the winter. Some of those can be plowed back in the spring if plowing is done, or just left to decompose, and then they add fertility to the soil. Some can be turned into crops and used for profit. And then the third method is to intercrop, which means planting the very deep-rooted prairie plants that formed the great soils of the Midwest in the first place, interspersed with the crop plant. And so there are some wonderful experiments that show that if you simply take 10% of the corn out of production and replace it with these deep-rooted prairie plants, that is sufficient to reduce erosion 95%, essentially knocks it down to almost insignificant.
You talked about barriers to this. Are they economic barriers? Are they labor barriers? What is preventing farmers, if we know that this is happening and we want to prevent it from happening, what's preventing us from fixing it?
Well, the big challenge is really economic. Farmers don't have enough of a margin, a profit margin, to suddenly adopt a whole new set of practices that will cost some initial capital investment or some other kind of investment. And they just don't have that leeway in the economics of farming. And so we need to have some sorts of systems that will help farmers get over that initial barrier, because all of these methods will ultimately pay for themselves, but they may require, for example, with no-till farming, you need the drill. So that's a capital investment to do the planting. Or you, for example, in the intercropping, there's a quirk in our crop insurance system where if a farmer says, I'm going to plant 10% less corn this year, and instead of that 10%, I'm going to plant these deep-rooted prairie plants that will nourish my soil, that's a great thing to do for the long term, and corn yields will probably go up within 2 to 3 years. But by taking 10% of the corn out of production, that will reduce the farmer's crop insurance by 10%. Well, that's a risk we can't ask our farmers to take. So there are some systematic problems that get in the way of farmers doing that. That being said, there are many farmers in Wisconsin and other states who have adopted all of these methods and other very innovative methods to restore or build soil.
Do farmers who are focusing on organic farming methods go to this a little more readily, or is it across the board, whether they're using more traditional agriculture or more organic-based?
There is more of a tendency of organic farmers to use these methods, definitely.
So what can consumers do to help farmers adopt these practices?
Well, it's very hard as an individual to find out where your food is grown and under what conditions. Certainly things like community-supported agriculture is one way that people do that, where they can actually meet the farmers and ask about methods that they're using. But I think we need something much broader at a national level and a consumer movement for soil-safe farming. And so my proposal is that if we had a sticker that's like the organic stickers, that if you're certified soil safe, you could put this soil safe certification on your food product, then consumers could decide whether they're willing to pay a small premium to support farmers who conduct soil safe farming. I think all we would need is some of the wholesalers for, you know, major food suppliers to get on board in order to make this profitable for farmers.
Well, we did that with organic foods, certainly, and with the whole farm to table and the idea. And I mean, I'm old enough to remember, you know, when food co-ops first really started in the 60s and 70s. And for a long time, it was a niche thing, but it isn't anymore. It seems to be everywhere. And I can't imagine that we couldn't use the same sort of methods to ensure the soil safety as well.
I think a great place to start is in meat production, because most of the most destructive farming is done with corn and soybeans. And those aren't grown for direct human consumption. Those are our Midwestern feed crops for animals. And so what if we started with soil-safe meat, which would mean that the meat had been produced with animals fed corn or soybeans, any kind of grains that were grown on land that was managed in a soil-safe way. I think that would create a premium type of meat, which I think the meat industry might even be looking for right now because, you know, meat is under all sorts of criticism to begin with because of health issues and climate change issues. And I think the industry or parts of it may be looking for new ways to market their product in a way that sounds more environmentally friendly, which being soil safe certainly would be. That might be a place to start because you're absolutely right. We've done this before, and the question is where do you start and how do you get the consumer on board for it?
From a scientific perspective, if we don't do soil safe farming, what are we looking at in the near and then distant future?
Well, it's going to vary across our crop acreage, but across the United States, the average soil loss on our agricultural land is about 4 tons of soil per acre per year is lost. Now, soil is produced at about 1/10 that rate. So it doesn't take a lot of math to figure out that that's not sustainable, that we're using the soil up, we're removing it from the land 10 times faster than it's being regenerated. But within that average across the United States, there's enormous variation, and there will be areas where there's no soil loss and then areas where there's quite enormous soil loss. And in fact, there have been some tracking of soil loss experiments in Iowa that have shown that not only does Iowa as a state, the average exceeds that national average, they're at almost 6 tons per acre, but there are areas that in recent years, because of the very high precipitation and severe rainstorms with these high momentum raindrops hitting the soil, which is very destructive to the soil, there are areas of Iowa that have lost 50 tons of soil in a single acre in a day because of one storm. And that's 10 times the average of soil loss for the state. And that's in a single day. So the concern is that, first of all, weather that is destructive to soil, those just extremely hard precipitation events are increasing quite rapidly. And they have been for the last 50 years, and it looks like they're going to increase in frequency at an even higher rate going forward. So we're putting the soil under more stress with the current climate trends, but some areas are already losing soil so fast that they will be out of soil in the very near future. So if you fly over the Midwest, you can actually see areas where there's no more surface soil, topsoil, and you can see the subsoil peeking through, which is the mineral layer that isn't really fit for growing crops. There's some evidence that pretty large tracts of land in the Midwest have already gotten to that state. And in the areas that are steeply sloped and are losing soil at a very high rate, we're going to see substantial acreages that have lost all of their topsoil by 2025, 2030. And then if we keep going at this rate, by 2050, I think we'll be in extremely severe soil loss condition.
It sounds like Dust Bowl times 1,000.
Yes, that's right. And what we're experiencing now, which is a little bit different from the Dust Bowl, is that it's not just the drought that caused the Dust Bowl, but it's now both drought, which can cause soil loss in areas like Kansas and Oklahoma and where the Dust Bowl was at its worst, but now it's also heavy precipitation that is a serious problem. And at the time of the Dust Bowl, we weren't seeing these trends of increasing frequency of these heavy precipitation events. So So now there are actually two forces driving soil loss at an increasing rate, and that's both the wind and water erosion.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot to do in a very short amount of time.
I agree, but what I think is the great news about this topic is that we have the means and the knowledge and the scientific wherewithal to fix it. And unlike some of the other global issues that we're dealing with today, where it's very hard to imagine a quick fix with soil loss, we can fix this and soil can be regenerated. And so if we stop eroding it and start building it, we can be in a much better place in terms of the condition of our soil in a very short time.
Dr. Joe Handelsman is a research professor and the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. Last month, she spoke about soil erosion at the Milwaukee Public Museum. That was a part of their Science on Tap series. There is more information about Dr. Handelsman's work at WUWM.com. Coming up next, how one Wisconsin family's devastating experience with medical error became a beacon of hope and a call for reform. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Medical error is the third leading cause of death in America. Miscommunication between medical practitioners themselves and between them and their patients can lead to life-changing outcomes for those patients and their families. In 2009, Stephen Burrow's mother, Judy, fell and went in for a routine partial hip replacement at the Aurora West Allis Medical Center. During the following months of difficult recovery, she fell again. Then after 8 days in the hospital and a second hip surgery where she lost a significant amount of blood, Judy fell into a coma that resulted in permanent brain damage. Burroughs is a comedian and filmmaker by trade, but he rapidly had to become an advocate for his mother. On the advice from friends and lawyers, the Burroughs family decided to sue Aurora for medical malpractice. So Burroughs filmed his mother and her pain levels to keep records for that impending trial. Those films turned into material for Burroughs' HBO documentary, Bleed Out. That film made its Wisconsin premiere at the Milwaukee Film Festival this past October, and it's since been screened all over the country. We're sad to report that Judy died on January 30th, so it's in her honor that we revisit our conversation with Steve Burroughs that aired before Bleed Out's Wisconsin premiere. At that time, he joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski and began by explaining why he decided to turn his mother's story into a documentary.
Well, this has been a 10-year process for us. When I started to film in the early days, I was actually told by our medical malpractice attorneys within the first few days that I needed to film her pain and suffering. I needed to make a record of that because no one else was going to do it. And that was through this whole process. Easily one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do in my life is like stick a camera in my mom's face, especially back when we didn't even know if she was going to survive or pull through or coming out of that coma. So I was basically just documenting everything for the record because we had no idea where this thing was going. And then as I got deeper into this medical industrial complex siege and I started to find out how difficult it was to get accountability and transparency and how it was hard to even find an attorney to even take your case. And even the best cases lose 90% of the time. A friend of mine thought that maybe, you know, I should start thinking a little bit bigger and maybe not just make it just about my, I had basically three things: take care of my mother, pursue justice the only way we could was in the court system. And then the backup plan, the plan C, was maybe make a documentary at some point. We were definitely 3 or 4 years into the litigation when I started to see how unbelievably difficult it was going to be. And I started to find out that medical error was the third leading cause of death in America and all these other things that you see in the film that I didn't know anything about. And I thought maybe we might want to open this up a little bit because this personal story seems to be a universal one.
It wasn't until about 6 years after the initial events that the trial actually happened. So in the meantime, you are dealing with your mother's care, insurance companies, medical doctors, back and forth between Aurora, all of these things that people sometimes get thrown into. But I feel like a lot of times, unless it's an acute case such as yours and your mother's, but a lot of people will get those letters in the mail, the things from insurance, and they'll just want to get it paid and over with and toss it aside and move on. So what have you learned from taking a deep dive, and what would you encourage people to do to look a little more closely when it comes to looking at their own medical care? Because I feel like a lot of stuff just slips under the radar.
Right. Well, that used to be me. I didn't know anything about any of this. I didn't know anything about advocating for a person, you know, in the healthcare system. This was kind of, my mom had made me power of attorney if anything ever happened. And we all, when we do those papers, when we get the papers together, you know, we go, nobody wants to talk about it because who wants to deal with that? But my mom actually did her papers just about 2 years prior to this. And we never thought we'd ever have to become, like, I'd have to become activated power of attorney. And then it hits you. Like, so what are you going to do with the one thing I would tell most people at this point is that, you know, we're all going to get sick. We're all going to have family members are going to get sick. And we're all going to end up in the hospital at some point where our loved ones are. And what I learned is you need an advocate. You need someone who is your wingman, wingwoman, sidekick. Because when you're sick, you're not thinking straight. And you're scared and you're frightened. And you need someone like I literally write on my – I have a little list here. I always have my questions. And you will get better care regardless of the institution. You're going to get better care if you have someone who is asking the basic questions, and there are no stupid questions. You know, this is your life. And occasionally you're going to irk a very busy doctor or nurse because they're probably overwhelmed as well. But it doesn't matter, you know, because it's going to force them to think about what they're doing, how they're doing it. The other thing I learn now that I wish I would have known this. I could have avoided this whole thing is if I would have gotten a second opinion, like right away for my mom's hip surgery, the first hip surgery. If I just would have gone to just get a nice, clean, and what I've learned is that great doctors and nurses and hospitals, the reason I didn't do it is I didn't want to offend the doctor. I didn't want to make him mad or think I didn't trust him because we trust these caregivers, doctors, and hospitals blindly. I didn't do it. But I look back now and I go, that second opinion, there would have never been – we would have avoided this whole thing. And I would also say that I've learned that you actually – you know, it's tough to want to deal with this stuff. No one wants to, but I'm telling you, your life depends on it. And you got to start shopping. You know, we all shop for houses and cars and clothes, but we're not shopping for, you know, if you need your tonsils out, if you need to have appendix surgery, or even a doctor's appointment. You're like, what doctors, what institutions are specialized in what's going on with you? I think that shopping, it's your life. And 10 years ago, I would have just, whatever.
Yeah, I'll get to it when it reaches a point where
exactly.
I can't stand it.
You can't wait.
Yeah.
Don't wait.
Mm-hmm. Our state legislature has made it more difficult for patients to fight against hospital negligence. So what is Wisconsin's place in this? And is it unique or is it just one example of a nationwide trend?
It's my understanding that the national trend is not good with this, patient safety. Every state has these organizations, and now we've been meeting people, especially the last 3 or 4 months, who are fighting in every one of their states for patient safety and patient rights. And like, can't we all – I mean, isn't this – shouldn't we all be on patient rights? Isn't that something we can all agree on? And there are laws in each state that are set up that – limit patients' rights. Wisconsin is one of the worst, without any question, one of the harshest. Even some of these laws, like the doctor privilege law or the I'm sorry law or the single person law, those are, even for these hardened pros who have been fighting for patients all these years, those laws shock the old pros. So it's bad here, real bad.
Another aspect to medical care that we all have to deal with is insurance companies. This film also shows just the widespread aspect of that medicine is corporate. It is a business, which in turn makes care impersonal. So do you think we're ultimately living with an inherently broken system if it's based off of business and policies and not about doctor-patient relationships at its core.
Right. Absolutely. In my experience, one should not – how do I say this? The size of your wallet should not determine the quality of the healthcare that you get. And I know that I've learned through the vast majority of hospitals and doctors and nurses that we've met through this process is they all want to do the right thing. You know, they want to spend more time with the patient, especially the doctors. That, you know, like an office visit. A lot of these doctors only can spend 10 to 15 minutes with a patient. And what they want is they want to be able to spend as much time with the patient as they need. And what we found in interviewing like the Mayo Clinic, we went to the Mayo Clinic in the film, and their whole thing is patient safety. The patient is first, not the money. Regardless of their ability to pay, you come into the Mayo Clinic and facilities like that, they look at you and it's all about what can we do for this patient? It's not about how many hip surgeries can we crank out a day. It's what does that one particular person need that day? And it works. But there's this money incentive, and you know the insurance companies, they win no matter what happens. Whether they pay or not, they're still making money, regardless of the outcome of any patient situation. It's like who's going to, you know, I keep asking in our film, like who is in charge of my mom's care, which I still don't know.
10 years later.
But who's in charge of healthcare? Like somebody tell me.
Overall, yeah.
Right. I've been asking some of the brightest minds in patient safety, like who's in charge of healthcare? And they're like, yeah, good question. That should frighten people. Scares me.
One thing that gave me pause was the whole aspect of telemedicine. So when your mother was moved to an ICU after her second hip surgery, there was a camera essentially watching over her in the corner that was linked to a remote care facility. You know, someone looking through monitors to check on patients versus a physical doctor right there with her post-surgery. And this is the focal point of what caused a lot of declining problems and long-term consequences. I wasn't even aware of telemedicine until this. So is this something that's very widespread, or was it just something that's being launched at several hospitals, or is it something that, again, is part of a system that's too big to fix or fail that is just a reality patients have to live with?
The telemedicine industry, especially this eICU thing, electronic ICU, is spreading like wildfire across the country. And I didn't know anything about it. And I'm glad you asked that question because I was in the hospital with my mother after she was found in a coma. I actually found her in a coma. I was the person who noticed that something was wrong. She'd been there for 2 days in the ICU. And we found out about it by accident. Nobody at that facility told us anything about this. We wanted to meet with the doctor who was in charge of my mom's care in the ICU that night. And they said there wasn't a doctor there, that there was a camera doctor out by the airport. And that's all we knew. And then we started to investigate. We went through litigation. We found out, at least in our case here in Wisconsin, that this electronic ICU camera, in my mom's case, replaces the bedside doctor in the intensive care unit. Now, there's great reasons to use telemedicine, but it does not replace the bedside doctor. And nobody knows about this. We didn't. And then we found out during our litigation, our trial, that this place, it's out by the airport on the corner of Grange and Howell. And that one facility, we found that there's one doctor every 8 hours watching 15 intensive care units, and they only have like, I guess, 4 or 5 monitors. And in our case, they told me the camera was never on with my mother. So I'm like, well, what's the I don't understand the point of this. And nobody knows about this. There was one doctor, our surgeon in our case, he claimed he never knew about it, and he was the surgeon. So if the surgeon didn't know, and if I didn't know, and you don't know 10 years later, I don't know what to tell you. That's one of the big reasons why we made this film, was when we found out about this electronic ICU, because I can tell you that critical care doctors across the country do not like this. You cannot...
Not in the you cannot, most critical time
yes,
of follow-up.
Yes, exactly. In intensive care, you cannot assess and manage a critical care patient through a camera that's not on.
There's a lot of questions about accountability, transparency. Now that we're 10 years down the road, I'm curious, have you heard anything from Aurora with this documentary?
Well, I have some breaking news for you. You're the first person to actually to know this because we never heard anything from Aurora until about a month and a half after the film came out, which was earlier this year. And I got a letter from the CEO of Aurora, and it was a handwritten letter sent privately. It was not sent, you know, certified or anything like that. And it was not made public. He didn't – I don't know why they didn't share it with everyone. But it was kind of an apology, not a full-throated apology. They're sorry that, you know, this happened to our family and the American healthcare system. You know, it was a nice letter. You know, they sent thoughts and prayers at the end, and there was no offer of any transparency or accountability. It was just like kind of acknowledging the story, acknowledging the film, and. You know, it was nice. So I wrote right back, and I sent it back to a letter back to the CEO to see if we could. I thanked him for the letter and see if we could meet to, you know, talk about things. I thought it was the beginning of a dialogue, and we have not heard back. And that's been 6 months.
Are you hopeful that'll also be a call to action for systems like Aurora, for people studying medicine, for people already employed in medicine?
Yes. One of the best things that's happened through this disaster has been, you know, when the film came out, we were so fortunate to get the response was just really very encouraging. But then the public got hold of it. You know, HBO and their tentacles of, you know, millions of people then saw this movie. And then we started winning a couple pretty important awards. We won the Los Angeles Press Club for Best Documentary. And then the non-for-profit organizations, healthcare organizations, started getting hold of this thing. The Leapfrog Group, the Patient Safety Movement, the Global Neurosciences Institute. These are like incredible organizations who have been doing this for years, who never had, you know, they have the story, they have the stats, they have the white papers, they have the research, but they've never seen, you know, it's different when you can feel it. I could have told you our story. But when we show it, when you see it, it's different. It's more powerful and it's more urgent, and that's what they're telling me. And then the next step is now universities and medical schools and nursing schools are making this a part of their curriculum to teach their medical students and residents and nursing students, because it's a 10-year kind of epic journey, and this really happened in America, and. We all make mistakes. You know, we're all humans, including doctors. Doctors are heroes, but things happen. It's not always negligence either. It's, you know, just sometimes things happen. The question is, when the mistakes are made, what are you going to do? And the best thing that's happened is the film has turned into a call to action. That was not the intention. I just wanted to tell my mom's story. But now it's no longer our movie. It's the patients out there and their families, and the fact that the medical community is embracing this film and using it as a teaching tool is the now my mom's legacy. That's her legacy. That all of her everything she went through. You know, I'm haunted by her pain and suffering to this day. People ask me if this has been a cathartic experience or it's been a healing experience. For me, somehow, if I found peace, no, but I can tell you that my mom's story is helping people get better care. And, you know, I'm really grateful for that.
Wisconsin native Steve Burrows is a writer, actor, and director. His latest documentary is called Bleed Out. His mother, Judy Burrows, passed away last week, 10 years after medical error altered her life. For more information about the film, please go to WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then welcome Milwaukee author Nick Petrie in to talk about his latest book, The Wild One. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. In January, Nick Petrie released the newest book in his Peter Ash series. The Wild One takes our intrepid protagonist, a Milwaukee native and a veteran of the Iraq War who suffers from PTSD, very far from his Wisconsin home and sets him up in an inhospitable yet beautiful place. Like in all of Petrie's books, the mystery Ash is trying to solve is compelling, the characters are sharply drawn, and the pace is relentless. The Wild One was released on January 14th. There was a launch at Boswell Book Company the night before, but Petrie came in to talk with us ahead of both of those things to set up the story.
In The Wild One, Peter goes to Iceland to find a young boy whose mother has been murdered by the boy's father. So he's sent on sort of a mission of mercy, but when Peter gets off the plane in Reykjavik, a man from the U.S. Embassy, for reasons unknown and unofficial, wants Peter sent home. And so in order to find the boy and catch a killer, Peter has to outwit and outfight and outlast the Icelandic cops, the boy's Icelandic family, and the largest winter storm Iceland has seen in a generation.
Just to add one more thing
to, right,
to give him something else to fight against. And I have to say, he's doing this by himself. He's kind of on his own on this one.
He is. Every book, I sort of give myself an assignment. And and part of the assignment for this one was to put Peter, is to really sort of isolate him and to make him as miserable as I possibly could, to see how deep he could dig and how much trouble he could get into and get out of.
Did he surprise you at all?
Yeah. This book was a very interesting process in writing this book. I had never really planned to write anything set in Iceland. I got talked into an Icelandic backpacking trip by my son about 2.5 years ago. And we went on this grand adventure. We went hiking across the Hornstrandir Nature Reserve, 5 days sort of crisscrossing, you know, from one side of the peninsula to the other. We got dropped off by a boat. We got picked up by a boat. There's no road access. It was this incredibly sort of isolated and beautiful and kind of scary place.
Sounds fantastic.
It was one of the peak experiences of my life was this trip with my son. But in the airport, waiting to get on our plane, the book sort of appeared in my head in all of a piece, which has never happened to me before. And I spent the next, you know, year and a half sort of trying to excavate it and turn it into a book.
I'm just trying to imagine like the entire book just sort of dropping into your head, and then the process of trying to like remember all the pieces.
Well, so I got about 20 minutes of clarity where I really could see all the pieces, all the moving parts. The characters really all kind of showed up, and I have a little notebook I carry with me everywhere I go, and I scribbled as fast as I could, sort of trying to capture as much as I could, and then it disappeared again. It's like trying to reconstruct some lost document on the basis of the scrawlings of a madman.
In the middle of the Reykjavik airport.
Yes, in the middle of the Reykjavik airport. After 11 days of hiking and staying up all night, because we went during the summer when
there is no dark.
There really is no dark.
Yeah.
Which is a whole different thing.
Yeah, because the book is set in the winter where there is no light, essentially.
Right.
And you have maybe 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day?
Yeah, and it depends on the weather. If it's clear, you get more light. If it's overcast or the clouds are, you know, right above the top of your head, which often happens in Iceland, you know, it really kind of never gets light at all. So, and that was sort of part of the atmosphere I was trying to create. You know, this is every book I don't really know this at the time, but I'm trying to riff on something or another. I wrote a book set in Denver about the cannabis industry that turned out to be kind of a Western novel in a way. And this one is, you know, sort of half Private Eye novel and half sort of Scandinavian noir.
I was going to say Scandinavian noir thriller.
I'll take that.
Because it's got that feel. I feel like I'm, you know, in the middle of, you know, some sort of Swedish television show. Except it's Icelandic. But yeah, it's that sense. And one of the things I noticed, because of course you and I have talked about, I think, all of your books, and I've certainly read them all, I notice the way you talk about Iceland. It's another character.
Well, I'm really interested in place. And when you write a series, which is what I do, and you set it all in the same place, it has a certain kind of character. But every place has a set of strengths and a set of limitations. And one of the great pleasures of writing this series, which each book is set in a different location. And so you get to really develop each setting as a character. And it both makes the books distinct from each other, you know, in a way that they wouldn't be necessarily if they were all set in Milwaukee, for example. But it helps me to direct the choices, to direct the story. So a story set in Memphis, which was my fourth book, is going to have a certain set of choices that are different from a story set in Iceland like this one.
Also, I couldn't help but think that the Iceland of my imagination, because I've not been there. It's on my bucket list. But the Iceland that I read about and the Iceland of my imagination mirrors Peter so well. There's like this sweeping dark with splashes of light and things happening and both cold and warm. And I thought, what a perfect place for him.
Well, it is, and it really pushes all of his buttons. It's especially in the wintertime, right? Peter has post-traumatic stress from his time in Iraq, and so he can't really be inside for very long. And in the winter in Iceland, you know, there's not a lot of outside to go to.
Not if you want to live.
Well, yeah, not if you want to be, you know, warm and above ground. And so, you know, again, it all kind of plays into, giving Peter a set of challenges.
Well, and also giving him challenges that really test him. I mean, what I love about the sort of the arc and the sweep of the book is that he and Iceland kind of have some face-to-face chats, you know, more than once.
Yeah, there are some come to Jesus moments.
Yes. And
you know, when you're somebody like I'm an outdoors guy. I've been a backpacker for 30 plus years. I would always generally rather be outside. That's something that Peter and I really have in common. But there's a certain intensity and a certain rawness when you are out on a mountain or in the middle of a wood somewhere that it really is just you. And that's sort of part of the character of Peter as well, and certainly in this book, where Peter does not have his friends to rely on, and in fact, in part, that's kind of his fault, his own choice. People always say to me, "So now, why do you have to be so hard on poor Peter?" And you know, that's kind of my job is to torture my characters to tell a more interesting story.
Well, and to have them grow into some interesting places,
right,
and figure
right.
out things about themselves. Yeah, and I, you know, there was a very big Lewis-shaped hole at the very beginning of it. I thought, wait, Lewis isn't here, but I found that as the story went on, I would have liked to have seen how he reacted to all of it, but I also didn't miss him. I felt like the story, it was okay that he was in California with his family during this whole thing, and that June wasn't there either, although she was in his head the whole time for various reasons. But that, yeah, that whole support system just, it was okay.
Well, when you're in the middle of the dark night of your soul, you know, it doesn't really matter who you're with, you're alone. And that's kind of part of what I was trying to do with Peter was to, kind of have him hit bottom in a fairly profound way.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, for me, character study of him. I mean, they're all character studies of him, but I got to know him in different ways and deeper ways in this book.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way, because that was part of the goal as well, is to sort of strip away, you know, all of the tricks I have given myself over the last books, and to have this sort of just be Peter, kind of out on his own. And it honestly scared the hell out of me, the idea of sort of doing something so elemental, past the point where I turned it in and I was waiting to hear what my editor had to say, and I still really had no idea, you know, what he was going to say.
And what did he say?
he said, "Wow." It was actually kind of an astonishing experience, because he was a stand-in. My editor was on maternity leave, my usual editor, and so this is my temporary editor was the guy who discovered Tom Clancy. So he's kind of a giant in the industry, and I got fewer notes from him on this book than I have for any other book. It was really just you know clean up a little here, do a little of this somewhere else. It just kind of boggled my mind, and I basically said, "So, you know, you're not just going easy on me because you just want to get this, you know, get this done with, so I can start the next one." And he's like, "No, if this needed work, you would know it." As a writer, it's always interesting because you spend so much time alone with the work, and at a certain point, you just can't see it anymore. You know, Margaret, my wife, reads parts of it. She'll often read the first big chunk to kind of say, "Okay, you're, you know, kind of on the right track." But really, nobody sees it until I send it off to my editor, and I'm holding my breath for a couple of weeks while I wait to hear.
Yeah, I bet. It's almost like this one was a dark night of the soul for you too.
A little bit, yeah. I had this spectacular mountain bike wipeout where I tore up my shoulder. I had to have surgery. The surgeon said that it was the kind of injury he generally sees with car accidents or hockey players. That
you really wiped out.
Oh no, it was I was moving fast.
It was a
very nice experience. But you know, and it kind of messed me up, and I was in bed for, you know, almost 2 weeks, and I told my agent, who is a certifiable piece of work, and her first words were, "Can you still type?"
Well, with one hand,
yeah, no,
maybe.
No pressure.
Yeah,
no pressure.
None at all.
So, you know, and it was a challenge. There were you know, some other things going on as well. So, you know, some books are easier than others, and this was one of the others.
But I think it was worth the slog through the Slough of Despond, if we can, you know, well, mix our metaphors here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that there was a point where I said to myself, you know, do I want to keep going with this, or do I want to start something else? And I really kind of went back and looked at it, and I just thought, I really like this story. I love writing about Iceland. There's something that is so compelling to me about the landscape. It's so primal. I don't know. I'm so glad I didn't cave. I'm so glad I didn't let myself weasel out and kept going.
Well, and I love your Icelandic characters too. There are a number of different ones that we meet along the way. Some are part of the family of the little boy, and some not. Or, well, I guess everyone's sort of related, kind of in some tangential way.
Well, in Iceland, everybody's sort of related,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That just because it's small,
right,
and you know, and somewhat self-contained, and so, but you captured that whole Nordic stoicism and just sort of practicality, but also just willingness to like throw it all out there and go when it's called for.
Well, it was actually one of the challenges was sort of, you know, when you don't, I don't speak Icelandic, and my experience there was limited. Duncan and I actually went twice, but it was still, you know, less than 3 weeks over the course of about 13 months. And it was hard to kind of figure out how to think about the Icelanders. And it really, when somebody said to me that Iceland is like the Wyoming of Europe, nobody recycles. There, you know, there's all this open space, and that sort of helped, because I've known a lot of people who live in places like Wyoming who are, you know, it's that self-reliance, and you're a little dwarfed by this gigantic, epic, ever-present landscape. And that really helped me, you know, sort of think about the people that I knew who had lived sort of, you know, on the last road, at the end of the last road. But it was so much fun to do, and this happens to me a lot, but, you know, some of these characters just kind of showed up. And it was like, oh, okay, so what do I do with this guy?
Who are you? Yeah. And why are you here? Okay,
right.
I guess we'll figure that
right.
out. Yeah. Well, in every book, there are always characters that I think, oh, I want to know what happened to that person, or I want to know the story of that person. You know, it's like I can see that if you were so inclined, you could write about that person, or you could write. And there were certainly a couple of people in this that I thought, you know, Bjarni was one, and I'm forgetting his name, the police captain.
Oh, Hjalmar.
Both of them. Both of them, and I thought they could each have their own series.
Well, that's such a giant compliment, because that's, to me, is the goal, is that you can imagine these characters having a life of their own somewhere else. I don't generally do book clubs because nobody actually reads the book in a book club, and it is my experience. But I did one for the first book, The Drifter, but years ago, and it was all women, and they had all read the book, and they all had very definite opinions about it. And at one point, I'm just sort of sitting in a chair watching, I don't know, 20 women argue about, well, Peter would do this or Peter would do that. And it was so wonderful to have this character have taken on sort of reality in the minds of these readers. So that is my goal in a way, and it's such a compliment to hear.
Well, I hope you do, because I kind of want to know what happens. I'm not going to give away the last time we see either of these guys, but they're in some interesting places, and I would love to. So maybe Peter goes back at some point.
Well, I'm wondering, at one point I get to go revisit some of the earlier characters. Mm-hmm. The thing about the series is there have so far really only been three recurring characters. There's Peter Ash, his friend Lewis, and June Cassidy, who's his sweet patootie. And, you know, my goal is to sort of keep these books sort of lean and flexible so that I can go any place and write any kind of story I want to write. But at a certain point, it's fun for the reader, and it's also fun for me to kind of bring characters back to see, you know, where they are 3 years out or 5 years out. Going back to read, you know, some of my favorite series, right? Robert Crace, the Elvis Cole, Joe Pike books are wonderful. And there are characters that come back, you know, every X number of books. Robert Parker did that as well in the Spencer novels, which are also some of my favorites.
Milwaukee native Nick Petrie is the author of the very successful Peter Ash series. The Wild One is the fifth and newest edition. It was released last month. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week. We get help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holdorf. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy, our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski, our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.